mention Tim Smiechek, the as yet untitled Coffee with Tayshan podcast. It's not the worst.
Yeah, I don't mind that.
You're coming off of a title in Charlottesville. We're recording this before you get underway in Knoxville. We're at the Golden Roast here, and you are the perfect first guest for a coffee type of a podcast.
I tend to agree with you on that.
What'd you get today?
Just a plain old drip coffee with a little cream.
How do you choose your coffees? Because I know you are incredibly particular about it.
I usually go with a lighter roast. Lately, I've been doing a lot of Ethiopias, or last week I really liked a Tanzania roast, or bean, I guess. I usually just ask for whatever's the lightest.
And how did you come to, because I know you're a rather educated, cultured man. I know you like your wines. There's no reason to laugh at that, because I know you like your wines as well. You've become quite educated on coffee as well. How has this developed for you over the last several years?
Yeah, all the finer things. I like to make believe I know what I'm talking about with wine. I enjoy my wine, and I know what I like, so I've got a couple of friends in the tennis world who I started drinking wine with. One of them's Kevin O'Connor, who's the president of Saddlebrook, where I train, and the other one's Craig Boynton, and we'll have a bottle from time to time.
How many glasses do you get out of that versus CD?
Well, we might have more than one bottle some nights, but so that's kind of where, and honestly, going to play the Napa Challenger a few times, and then a few other tournaments, within spitting distance, might sometimes just make the trip to Napa. That's always been fun for me.
That leads to an actual question about, you and I know that, especially a lot of the younger guys, I think back to maybe some of the guys you came up with many, many years ago, like to enjoy the party lifestyle. There is the idea of how do you balance going out, having a drink or two, in your case, having a glass of wine or two, versus being a professional athlete. How do you balance that when you're on the road?
Sure. Well, it took me a couple of years to find that balance. I definitely, my first couple of years on tour, I was, not the most professional, and I liked to have fun. So, for me, I can, these days, I can enjoy having a glass of wine and not really have any ill effects the next mm-hmm. day. So there's not, I might skip a glass of wine at dinner if I've got an early match or something, but for me, it's not, it's not really that much of a trade-off. And honestly, as I get older, the hangovers are just so much more intense, so it's just not worth it.
When do you allow yourself to relax and just kind of, not to bring up a hangover, but when you're allowed to kind of relax, have 2, 3, 4 drinks? And
sure. Yeah, no, I mean, one of my favorite things to do is when I get home after a trip, my wife and I will cook dinner and we'll have a bottle of wine. We'll relax a little bit more after I get off the road and have a few days where I don't need to be, training or thinking about tournaments yet.
You're one of the few guys out here who are married. How has that changed you over the last couple of years, even before you were married and had this long-term committed relationship? How has that changed how you structure your schedule? How has that changed just how you structure things on the road?
I try to shorten my road trips a little bit. Anne and I are very lucky that, with her job, she's able to schedule, you know, clusters of days off. So, you know, she travels a bit. Yeah, you know, I very rarely will play more than three tournaments in a row. If we're in the States, if I'm not on the West Coast, I might sneak home for, you know, if I lose early in a tournament, I might sneak home for, mm-hmm. for 2 or 3 days. So, you know, it puts things in perspective a little bit. You know, it's nice to have somebody to go home to. It's nice to be really excited to go home and you know, just be home with my wife. And it's kind of gives you an out to, you know, get on the first flight after a match.
Yeah.
You know, but I've always, even before I was married, I was a little bit more of a homebody. I liked being home as much as I could, but now it's just even more so, I guess.
When you play these challengers, maybe a little bit more so than when you're up at the ATP level, you're one of the older guys at this level. Do you feel segregated from them, the rest of the guys, a little bit in terms of just age, or even the fact that you're married and maybe they're out on a Tinder date or something along those lines?
Well, I know a couple of players my age who still go out on Tinder dates, so that's not...
I'm not judging.
Yeah,
don't get me wrong.
Right, me neither. You know, when I was one of the younger guys... it was really nice because some of the older players, you know, were just very friendly and they kind of took us under their wing. And
who was that for you?
Well, I mean, I lived with Marty Fish for a while. I've been close with James Blake for a long time. So those sort of guys, but also, you know, when we would be playing challengers, it was, you know, we would hang out with Robert Kendrick, mm-hmm. or Bobby Reynolds, Amir Delek, those sort of guys. And they were always, you know, very friendly and, you know, they weren't afraid to tell us we were idiots for, you know, going out and having too many beers or something like that. So, you know, I've tried to kind of do the same thing with some of the younger guys. We all get along real well. You know, I definitely, there are times where they make me feel very old.
Try being my age.
Yeah. Right. but I, you know, I think we get along real well.
Do you have an understanding or a realization of the fact that you're kind of a cult hero? A cult hero amongst the tennis world? Like the idea of people celebrating Smee bombs, your aces? I mean, it's...
I didn't even know that.
It's
no.
a thing.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
I think there's an appreciation of the fact that you're a smaller guy. You're like an average human being, if you will. You're not some 6'5" monster. Do you take pride in something like that? That people can relate to you a little bit more than maybe they can somebody who can drop 145 at the drop of a hat?
Trust me, if I had a choice of being my size or Riley Opelka's size, I think I'd, you know, be a no-brainer. But I guess I'll say being my size or stature or whatever, you know, I really believe that I have to work harder at certain things than most guys. And so, you know, if anything, I hope that, you know, people will just take that from it and see that you know, it's just a kind of a testament to hard work and professionalism. Because I think, you know, probably 7 or 8 years ago, I was sat down and had a talk with Craig Boynton,
mm-hmm.
and it was really kind of a turning point in my career. And he asked me, you know, what my goals in tennis were, and I told him, and he looked at me and he said, "Do you really think that you're going to get there kind of doing what you're doing now.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of a, you know, shot to the gut. You know, kind of from that point on, I had to make a decision to not take tennis more seriously, because I always took it seriously, but to, you know, really recognize the hard work it was going to take, but also the you know, just it being a full-time job, you know, that I couldn't have the sort of life that normal 21-year-olds or whatever I was at the time.
Yeah, it's not just an excuse to travel.
Right.
And meet all sorts of interesting people.
And that's kind of what gets lost on the normal, you know, non-tennis player. Seems real glamorous, but, you know, I might have a six-hour work day, but, you know, those 6 hours are pretty intense. And, you know, if I go home and lay on the couch for a couple hours, it's not because I'm lazy, it's because I can't get up.
to interrupt, so I'm drinking a drink here. We haven't talked about it, called the Sunrise.
You are more adventurous than I am.
Yeah, I like to get out and explore a little bit. This is orange juice with a shot of espresso.
And hazelnut syrup.
Yeah, it is.
Sounds like one of those, you know, when you're a kid and you go to all the different...
the hurricane.
The soda fountain.
That's what we always called it.
Yeah, it kind of sounds... like that.
It does. It definitely needs a little bit more sweet, but we're on the Tennessee campus. I think they're trying to use the orange as a...
Yeah, you know, I didn't think of that. That must be it.
You know, my Airbnb's two blocks up. I don't think I'm going to come back and...
Not for that.
...get that again.
Yeah.
So, you just finished your first title in 2 years. I know it's been a long process for you to get back, and you've gone through coaching changes. You were with Dustin for a while. You obviously had that long relationship with Billy. You went without a coach for a while. Now you're back with Dustin. How does, not necessarily just you, but how do you think players should look for in a coach? What are the things that are important? Because you see a lot of coaches, especially national coaches, who have three or four guys under their wing, and that's the same with you right now with Dustin. How do you think a player, what should they look for when trying to partner with a coach?
You know, I think at different points in your career, you're going to look for different things in a coach. I think for a younger guy, it's really important to have somebody that's just going to be there day in and day out. And not that younger players need a babysitter, but younger players kind of need someone to hold them accountable day in and day out. And that's actually kind of what I've gotten back into a little bit with Dustin. Mm-hmm. It's been good to, you know, have somebody to basically give me a lesson plan every day, or, you know, just figure out how I'm going to get better every day. And one thing I'll say is that I've been really lucky. My last two coaches have had just off the charts tennis IQs, and so you know, that's not necessarily something that I'm good at.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's you know, the emotional part of it or whatever, but one thing that I noticed when I was without a coach for 9 months or so is that I had really a lot of trouble analyzing matches. And I would just walk off the court scratching my head and wasn't sure why I lost matches. So for me, I really have a lot of trust in Dustin, and I really trust that he's, you know, sending me in the right direction, and that we're working on things that are going to make me a better tennis player. So I think if that's kind of the first thing that somebody should look for in a coach, is someone that you can really trust. And, you know, you believe that kind of they know better than you. You know, there have been times where I was working with a coach that, you know, you're always, you might disagree with with a coach, but if it's kind of constant and you start to lose faith that they know what they're talking about, that's where a relationship can break down.
Do you think coaching is something that will be in your future down the line? I mean, is that a mentality that you have?
No, it really isn't. I plan on getting out of tennis. Tennis has been really good to me, but I'm really looking forward to not traveling. I think to succeed as a coach, you have to be on the road a lot.
Right.
And that's just one of the things I fantasize about sometimes, is just getting off the road. And, you know, whenever it is that I retire a year from now, a couple of years from now, is just getting to be at home and not having to think about catching a flight the next day or something. That's something I really look forward to. So, No, I don't think coaching's in my future.
I mentioned this. I asked you this after you won on Sunday, but just, you know, I'd heard rumors of retirement for you, that this was going to be kind of the last go around this year. But obviously, there's a lot of work that you've been putting in, and I know you're playing well. So how are you structuring, and where is your mindset over the next year, 2 years, and how you're going to balance that?
Well, when you know, I had some dark days earlier this year. It's really easy to lose perspective when you're just losing a lot of tennis matches.
Yeah.
Tennis players really kind of derive a lot of their self-worth from their ranking and you know, the matches they win and lose. I definitely had some days earlier this year where I was thinking a lot about hanging it up. You know, I spoke to Dustin frequently, and you know, he told me a couple of times, just hang on for a little while, and then maybe in May or so, he told me that that he was gonna come back with the USTA, and that he was gonna see if, you know, he could help me out, and then he said, just, you know, give me 2 years. And, you know, you've got another chapter in you, and, you know, give yourself a couple more years. And so, you know, really the turning point was just when I started working with him this summer. And right away, you know, I still lost a couple of matches, but right away I started to see changes in my game, and
was it more technical or the emotional game management stuff?
Yeah, game management stuff.
Okay.
We don't really work on technique or anything, but game management and you know, strategy and tactics and that sort of thing, and just figuring out a way to think my way through matches. That's the other thing is the end of last year and first half of this year, you know, just kind of lost the ability to think my way through matches. So that's really satisfying, you know, to figure things out.
Yeah.
So that's been a major part of it. So I'm trying not to put too much of a deadline on myself and you know, don't really want to think about that now, and feel like things are moving in the right direction.
While we were driving over here, you were listening to NPR, and I hope you don't mind me saying that.
Not at all.
You're a thinker. I think everybody who talks to you knows that, but you're also not somebody who likes to share. You're not a Twitter person. You're not much of a social media person. How do you balance that in terms of, you know, realizing that you are a public persona, a personality that people, you have fans, with also keeping things in your life private, so that you don't overshare? And it's a very difficult balance that I think a lot of, like, the 18 to 22 year olds, they just really struggle with.
Yeah. I'm not sure when it was, but at some certain point I realized, like, you know, nobody probably really cares about what I'm thinking right now, you know, I sometimes see people on social media or, you know, Twitter, Instagram, and just sharing, and I think to myself, who cares? you know, some people have, you know, really interesting insights into life or into tennis or whatever you're following them for, but I just don't feel like I have that much to
it's interesting because I think people who know you, myself included, would disagree. Like I find myself always interested to talk to you because I think you do have an analytical mind. So when I want to when we talk tennis, which is not too often, I always value your insight. I know how much you do think about things like politics. And so I think there would be a lot of people who are actually interested. But it's a very difficult thing because I think right now in our country you have this growing imbalance
divide.
Between... Yeah, it's gotten really bad. So do you feel that there's ever a point where you would want to step into that role? There are so many tennis players who embrace it, so many who just mock it. Is there ever a point where you would step forward and say, I would like to take a stand on one particular issue?
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's just, I mean, I know some of the nasty messages that I get just about tennis, you know, and losing matches. And so, I sometimes can't even begin to imagine what people would say if I, you know, said something about abortion or healthcare or something like that. You know, whenever I catch myself wanting to say something publicly about that, I kind of pause and say, well, who am I? You know, because there are people who you know, devote their lives to that sort of stuff and know a heck of a lot more than I do. I definitely have my opinions, but I like to listen more than speak or tweet.
That's not something that ever happens now.
Well, but you see people put their foot in their mouth way too often.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's just, there's too much ugliness in the world these days, and you know, kind of, you know, at least on Twitter and Instagram, people, you know who my wife is, and so I guess a certain amount of that is trying to shield her from that.
Sure,
I have gotten nasty messages about my wife, even, which is just crazy. So, you know, no sense in giving people more fuel.
Okay, well, then the next step would be, I know you're a man of faith as well. How can you, or how can anyone, bring a more positive message? How can you impact communities where you get to travel to? How can you spread more of the love, more of the positivity while you have this platform?
That's a good question, and if you have any ideas, you can let me know. Over the last year or so, I tried to organize a couple of little field trips for guys at tournaments to go to local children's hospitals. We did that here last year. We did it in Houston a couple of years ago. So, I guess you know, as far as that goes, it's a pretty small platform. Funny story. Somebody, you might have seen this. Somebody on Twitter a couple of weeks ago tweeted at me that they saw me in the grocery store.
I did see that. Yeah.
Something about being a big tennis fan, and I said, "You must be a really, really big tennis fan." Yeah, I'm open to ideas. One of the things that Dustin is big on is you know, and this was kind of their whole mantra at UVA is making the world a better place through tennis. And, you know, that might mean different things to different people. You know, I saw a story the other day about how much money Roger Federer has raised for schools in Africa, which is pretty incredible. And, you know, I'm probably not going to be able to have that sort of impact in my lifetime, but, you know, I'm just kind of still searching for that. And you know, the thing that I try to remind myself is just to not be a dick on the court,
because
you see it a lot. that's kind of the best thing I've come up with is to, you know, act in a way that, you know, that I'm not going to be ashamed of later.
Do you feel a necessity to express that to younger players? I bring that up because a couple days ago, your final with Tennis Sandgren, and obviously Tennis had some issues with the crowd at times where he expressed it to the crowd, and I mean, we've seen it in so many different players. Is there a way you can teach that and help other players understand why that's important? How do we do that?
I don't know. It's kind of tough because we're in tennis, we're getting kind of mixed messages. You know, a lot of people like to say that tennis is missing a John McEnroe type figure,
right.
And that you know, some of the uglier stuff is good for tennis because it gets people to watch. And, you know, I understand that, but that's just not me. And so I don't know. I guess it's not you know, one way is right or wrong. I mean, as long as you're not hurting anybody,
right?
Or, you know, but this way is just right for me, and it's you know, I know my parents watch a lot on the live streams.
Yes,
so,
they do.
You know,
your dad checks in with me every once in a while.
So don't want to. I know, you know how they raised me to act, and kind of got to do right by them.
Well, we're hitting this 30-minute mark, and I kind of want to keep it under that because I think a lot of people don't like to listen for a full hour, especially to me, since I'm going to be doing 12 hours of broadcasting today anyways. But you're on the road. What do you look for in a coffee shop when you're in a new place? You've been to so many. You've been in Knoxville plenty of times. You knew exactly where this place was. What do you look for in a new coffee shop? Because I know you're not a Starbucks guy.
Yeah, so I look for kind of just the trendiest looking coffee shop because without fail they have the best coffee. You know, if they roast their own beans, it's even better. Yeah, just something that's small and out of the way, and you know, if they do like pour overs, stuff like that, that's always good. Last week at Shenandoah Joe's, they do only pour overs, so. You know, that's one of the best spots all year.
And at this point, do you just have locations in every spot that you're set, you go to, or do you explore a little bit, like Knoxville? Do you go to different places?
I've got two or three places that I go to here. Really only had one last week. Haven't found a good one in Champaign.
I've got you taken care of.
Okay, yeah. But other than that, I've got a pretty good idea most.
Have you been to Cafe Kopi in Champaign?
No. I haven't been to Champaign in a couple years.
Okay. So. Cafe Kopi, Paradiso, and Urbana?
I've been to Paradiso.
Okay.
It's okay.
Yeah. And then there's a new one that I'll get you to. It's like Flying Machine.
Sounds trendy.
Really trendy.
That's perfect.
Hippie.
Can't wait.
And they make pizza at the same time.
Pizza and coffee.
Tim, thank you so much for joining us, being the initial coffee cast participant. We appreciate it.
I thought this went well.